We come together this morning to take pause from the hectic days, to pay attention to that which sustains us, provides meaning, and gives us hope. For this hour at least, let us see each other and know we are not alone. Listen to our hearts and know we can still dream. And touch the higher plane and know we can connect to life. This place, our sanctuary of silence and laughter, memory and peace, is energized by our commitment together. Let that energy begin with song.
This morning we have a reading from a book of poems by Al Zelenas. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, but that's his name. And this one is called The New Physics, and it was written for Vishav Kapra. And so, the closer he looks at things, the farther away they seem. At dinner, after a hard day at the universe, he finds himself slipping through his food. His own hands wave at him from beyond a mountain of peas. Stars and planets dance with molecules on his fingertips. After a hard day at the universe, he tumbles through himself, flies through the dream galaxies of his own heart. In the very presence of his family, he feels he is descending through an infinite series of Chinese boxes. This morning, when he entered the little broom closet of the electron looking for quarks and neutrinos, it opened into an immense hall, the hall into a plane, the steps of Mother Russia. He could see men hauling barges up the river, chanting faintly for their daily bread. It's not that he longs for the good old Newtonian days, although something of plain matter and simple gravity might be reassuring, something of the good old equal but opposite forces. And it's not that he hasn't learned to balance comfortably on the seesaw of paradox. It's what he sees in the eyes of his children, the infinite black holes, the ransomed light at the center.
I didn't know until today that a hymn could be more difficult than relativity physics. We come now to the center of our service and a time for meditation. Please feel free to use this time to light candles of memory and hope, or just to sit quietly and remember why you are here. Well, I want to thank everybody for coming out today, despite the fact that there's an equation actually on the order of service. I had talked to Davidson very early in the year about doing this program today, and knowing I was going to speak a little bit about Albert Einstein, I have avoided the barber shop for a while. One of my intellectual heroes is the French mathematician and physicist Henri Poincaré. This was because he is universally regarded as the last generalist, that is, the last person to do original work in all branches of mathematics. In 1902, Poincaré wrote a book called Science and Hypothesis, in which he posited three fundamental problems that befuddled physics. First, the motion of particles suspended in liquid, which was called Brownian motion. Nobody could explain it. Second, the strange fact that when light hit a sensitive metal plate, and electrons were knocked off. Nobody could explain that. And it was a phenomenon called the photoelectric effect. And finally, the abject failure of physicists to detect the ether, which was a hypothesized medium in space through which light waves were said to propagate. 3 years later, in 1905, a 26-year-old patent clerk living in Bern, Switzerland, named Albert Einstein, solved all three of these problems and then some. Quote, "A storm broke loose in my mind," Einstein said about that heady year. Between March and September of 1905, he published five remarkable papers, all without citation to any other work, which either created or transformed a field of physics. Physicists call 1905 Einstein's miracle year. In honor of the 100th anniversary of the miracle year, 2005 has been declared the World Year of Physics by the United Nations General Assembly, the United States Congress, and a host of physics institutions around the world. Celebrations are happening in more than 30 nations. In the United States, scores of universities have conducted or plan to conduct programs in honor of Einstein's accomplishments and to generally promote science. And what accomplishments they were. I promised to talk physics for only a minute or two in order to sum up what happened in 1905. Most famously, Einstein created special relativity, and with it, the only equation Stephen Hawking's publishers would allow him to put in his book, A Short History of Time. You all know it, E equals mc squared, which was derived in its own three-page paper that might as well have been an addendum to Einstein's original paper on special relativity. Ever pithy, Einstein described relativity this way. Put your hand on a hot stove for a minute, and it seems like an hour. Sit with a pretty girl for an hour, and it seems like a minute. Special relativity was subsumed into general relativity, published in 1915, which overturned Isaac Newton's theory of gravity. Relativity revolutionized how we view space and time and led to the development of atomic power and nuclear weapons. Now, in explaining the photoelectric effect, Einstein discovered that light is both a wave and a particle and set the foundations for quantum mechanics, one of the most important disciplines of the 20th century. It was for this discovery on the photoelectric effect and not relativity that Einstein was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1921. The irony here, of course, is that Einstein never accepted quantum mechanics as a sensible picture of the universe, asserting that, quote, God does not play at dice. In the third of the big three papers, Einstein proved the correctness of atomic theory in explaining that Brownian motion was caused when particles suspended in a liquid collide with the atoms or molecules that make up that liquid. That may sound obvious now, but back then, Einstein's paper was crucial in converting the very last skeptics of atomic theory. Oh, and Einstein also published his thesis dissertation in 1905, and it remains one of the most cited scientific papers ever. Through his radical and revolutionary discoveries, Einstein became the very symbol of genius in the 20th century. Einstein, however, frequently downplayed his brain power with statements such as, quote, I have no special gift. I am only passionately curious. But there was no denying that Einstein was eccentric. His famously chaotic hair actually represented a famously chaotic personality. Einstein never learned to drive, for example, and his lack of fashion sense would appall any self-respecting metrosexual. But, as always, Einstein had a clever quip to disarm his critics. Comparing the difficulty of physics and fashion, Einstein remarked, quote, once you can accept the universe as matter expanding into nothing that is something, wearing stripes with plaid comes easy. And Einstein was famous. Oh, was he famous. He's the only scientist to achieve pop star status, something that has endured, if not increased, after his death 50 years ago. I think part of the magic of Einstein is that most people do not understand much of what he did, but they know it was important, they know it changed the world, and he seemed like a very self-effacing, harmless eccentric who was accessible and not encased in some ivory tower. Whatever the reasons for it, Einstein used his celebrity to speak out against fascism, racial prejudice, and the McCarthy hearings. He was the only scientist with enough prestige and authority to sign the letter that convinced Franklin Roosevelt to authorize the creation of the atomic bomb. And in 1952, just 3 years before his death from heart failure, he was offered the presidency of Israel, which he politely declined. It is difficult to overestimate how large an influence Einstein's theories, especially relativity, have had on us and our culture. Here is one physicist's appraisal of that. Quote, we are a different race of people than we were a century ago, says astrophysicist Michael Schara of the American Museum of Natural History. Utterly and completely different because of Einstein. So for all these reasons and many more, Time magazine declared Albert Einstein to be the person of the century, and this year has been proclaimed his year. That's all I'm going to say about Einstein directly today. And if you're interested, there are a number of good biographies about him, including the one by Ronald W. Clark, which many people feel is the definitive work. Instead, I want to use the rest of this time to talk about the impact that Einstein and science generally has had on us over the last century. Because I think it is ironic, that the world is celebrating science this year, is trying to use this anniversary to rekindle interest in science across the globe. It is ironic because although the 20th century was the greatest 99 years of scientific and technical progress in the history of Western civilization, much of it on the back of Einstein, I think it would be a mistake to claim we are a scientific society. I grant you that because we live in a highly technological society, it is only natural to believe that we also live in a highly scientific one. In fact, I believe that just the opposite is true. Let me give you a few statistics I took off the internet that I at least find disturbing. The belief in pseudoscience and fundamentalist religious assertions is staggering. Listen to this. 47% of people surveyed in the United States said they believe that the book of Genesis was literally true. 65% believe in Noah's flood. 41% believe that dinosaurs and humans lived at the same time. But it's not just religious fundamentalism. According to a survey taken by the National Science Foundation, 70% of Americans do not understand the scientific process. 40% believe in astrology. 60% agreed strongly that some people have psychic powers. And 30% think UFOs are genuine alien spaceships. Belief, not knowledge, is the preferred currency today. Magical, superstitious, and irrational thinking are everywhere. And the dedication to facts and the truth those facts reveal is sorely lacking in virtually every aspect of our culture. This phenomenon is, I think, directly correlated with the fantastic strides made by science in illuminating the nature of the world and human beings' relation to it. It has been said that the darkest shadows are cast by the brightest lights. The bright light of science has cast terribly dark shadows for many people, who desperately cling to superstition, mythology, and naked belief in order to feel comfortable and at home in the world. Thus, rather than enhance the scientific and fact-based framework of reality, I think that the development of relativity and quantum mechanics, as well as other intellectual paradigms of the 20th century, including evolution, psychiatry, genetics, and many more, has resulted in an alienation of many people who either do not understand or do not want to understand the implications of our scientific discoveries, and therefore have chosen to base their perception of reality and the conduct of their lives on something other than the cold, hard facts. Now, this is quite a turn of events from what our ancestors just a few hundred years ago believed would happen. The appeal to rationality, to science, to reason, was seen during the Enlightenment as inevitably bringing about progress in how people lived, progress for the better, progress that would eventually lead to the perfecting of the world. Unitarians are fond of quoting Thomas Jefferson's prediction that once all men became rational and reason held sway, then they would all be Unitarians. Well, Thomas Jefferson was a brilliant man of many wonderful accomplishments, but apparently being a seer was not one of them. We Unitarians remain a small minority religion, and in terms of influence are arguably less influential as a movement than we were in the late 19th century, when many of the patron saints of the denomination, like Ralph Waldo Emerson, held sway, and divinity schools like Harvard were populated by many Unitarian thinkers. What happened? We don't have near enough time today to discuss that issue. Part of it, I believe, is as I suggested. Science has revealed a world that is harsh, incomprehensible to the average person, and very unlike what we wish it would be. And our world is full of uncertainty, ambiguity, and a sense of insecurity kicked up many notches by 9/11 and war. In this regard, I think, Albert Einstein and relativity get a bad rap. That is, Einstein has been blamed or credited, take your pick, by many for the development of moral relativism during the 20th century. Today, moral relativism is a curse word by conservatives and the religious right. And while I utterly disagree with them regarding the value of thinking about morals in a relative rather than absolute way, it is also simply untrue that moral relativism derived from Einstein's theory of relativity. First of all, Einstein never said everything is relative, there are no absolutes. In fact, Einstein developed relativity theory, which he preferred to call a theory of invariances, so that all observers, in whatever reference frame, can get the same answers to their physics experiments. It is true that various measurements will be different in each reference frame, but there are right answers, the same ultimate answers that everybody would agree are correct. Einstein did not bring about the end of certainty in knowledge. By fixing the problems that Poincaré had pointed out, he actually restored it. Now, this did not stop the pundits from associating new ideas in art, literature, and music with Einstein's theory of relativity. Einstein rejected all such associations. Nevertheless, despite what Einstein said or didn't say, the phrase, everything is relative, entered into our culture and became synonymous with the notion that there is never an absolutely right answer to any question. The phrases, it's all relative and everything is relative, combined for about 165,000 hits on Google. This concept has saturated our culture in a way that Einstein would both reject and never imagine, and has led, I believe, to the transformation of the belief that everybody is entitled to his or her own opinion into the belief that each and every opinion must be respected because there is actually no right answer to anything. This concept, and so much more, has also provided a basis for all those who long for the good old days of traditional values, solid cultural boundaries, and certainty to come together and rebel against the culture that, to them, has lost its moorings and exists in a world of ambiguity and doubt with no boundaries, no guidance, and no rules. This is decidedly not what Jefferson had in mind when he foresaw a world where Unitarianism was the dominant religion. Now, despite my discomfort with all this, it might not matter so much if the people who believed in unscientific, irrational things kept their beliefs to themselves. But that is decidedly not the case with regard to religious fundamentalism. Fundamentalist religions of all denominations are the fastest growing religions in the world. And you don't need me to tell you about the growth of fundamentalist Christianity in this country and the increasing amount of power and influence Christian fundamentalists wield. Right after the last election, Time magazine's cover story was on the 25 most influential fundamentalists in the country. They, and millions like them, have, to their credit, gotten off their backsides and entered into the fray, and now have influence and sometimes control at all levels of government and are seeking more. And the effects are being felt over much of the country. Here are just a few examples. You probably know some of these. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, the board governing the local zoo has authorized the construction of an exhibit that presents biblical creation as the explanation for how animals got to this planet and their diversity. The justification used for doing this was, in part, that a small statue of an elephant in the style of Hinduism was present at the zoo. At a park called Dinosaur Adventureland, run by creationists near Pensacola, Florida, visitors are informed that man coexisted with dinosaurs. This fantasy accommodates the creationist view that the Earth is only 6,000 years old and that Darwin's theory of evolution is false. At the Grand Canyon, the Department of the Interior is selling creationist literature that claims that the canyon was made during Noah's flood and not over many millions of years of erosion by the Colorado River. This situation got the attention of scientists from seven organizations who sent a joint letter to the Department of the Interior demanding that the literature be removed from the bookstore. But when Grand Canyon National Park Superintendent Joe Alston attempted to block the sale of the book, he was overruled by headquarters. I can report to you that the privately run Noah's flood tours of the Grand Canyon have been canceled for economic reasons. But as far as I can ascertain, the Bush administration still condones the sale of the book. In Texas and around the country, fundamentalist pharmacists are refusing to fill prescriptions for birth control pills and other related devices based on personal moral standards. Legislation has been introduced in a number of states to specifically authorize this behavior. The Catholic Church has become more vocal on issues of science and religion. Two pieces in the Times last week, one called Finding Design in Nature, and the other called Leading Cardinal Redefines Church's View on Evolution, He Says Darwinism and Catholicism May Conflict, both assert the view that evolution is in conflict with Catholic teaching. And it is impossible not to note that yesterday, J.K. Rowling sold millions of copies of the sixth volume in the Harry Potter series, a series that the Pope, who as a cardinal was head of what used to be called the Inquisition, has condemned. According to signed letters scanned and published on LifeSiteNews.com, a family-oriented news portal on the internet, Benedict wrote in 2003 to the author of a book critical of the Potter series, quote, "It is good that you enlighten people about Harry Potter, because those are subtle seductions which act unnoticed and by this deeply distort Christianity in the soul before it can grow properly," unquote. Now, my soul is probably too old and already corrupted for the Potter books to do much damage, but I picked up my copy of the sixth volume yesterday and have already read the first 130 pages. Finally, and I could go on, in Cobb County, Georgia, the Board of Education required that stickers be placed into science books that asserted that evolution is only a theory. The stickers read, quote, "This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered," unquote. This sticker is in keeping with the president's own scientific understanding of evolution, which he expressed when he said, quote, "On the issue of evolution, the verdict is still out on how God created the earth," unquote. Now, it's true that the sticker requirement was struck down by the courts, but that's not the point. The point is that fundamentalists are everywhere trying to remake the world in their image, trying to undo 400 years of scientific progress in our understanding of ourselves and the world, trying to make the world safe, Christian, and dogmatic so that they can luxuriate in their framework of life. A framework that at its heart is, I believe, unsupportable, but one that is also full of hope, promise, and self-satisfaction. Now, it is unreasonable and unrealistic to believe that fundamentalists are going to give up their religion, their beliefs, and the hope, promise, and satisfaction that they provide merely because somebody points out that scientific observation conflicts with those beliefs. You understand nothing about the human heart and soul if you do not understand the lengths to which they will go to keep an unwanted truth at bay. And you understand nothing about the power of fundamentalist religion if you do not understand how deeply and powerfully it affects the people who surrender to it. The heart and soul do not care if something is true in the scientific, intellectual sense in order to become attached to it. Human beings have the ability to invest themselves in beliefs that have no rational basis. You all know that. It happens all the time. But what quality of belief allows it to persist in the face of insurmountable evidence against it? This is a complicated question, one that I wish I knew the answer to. But I think we begin to understand it when we realize that whatever gives life purpose, meaning, and hope is the stuff that moves our hearts and is believed. And for most people, there seems to be an imbalance between belief and knowledge and how they affect them. Knowledge tends to feed the intellect. Belief tends to feed the heart and soul. For so many people, satisfying the heart and soul, however it is done, is what is important in life. The rest, it doesn't matter much. Many Unitarians, in contrast, are the kind of people who, as Davidson is fond of saying, believe in salvation through bibliography and are much more dedicated to the intellect than is the average person. The problem is that not only are they, we, in the minority, but the millions upon millions of people who believe in things that are irrational, delusional, unscientific, and downright wrong will never give up those beliefs on the basis of mere facts. We live, I believe, in a post-factual age. Image is everything. And in a world where all things are relative, where everybody is entitled to his or her opinion and have it respected out of PC etiquette, where there are no firm, absolute answers, then anything goes. And belief, something that is at least an order of magnitude stronger than mere knowledge, will have its day. I fear we are in danger of losing the gains made in the last 400 years against superstition, fear, and irrationality. Many before us have paid a high price to bring our culture to this point of understanding of the world and our place in it. Bruno was burned at the stake because he asserted that the stars were suns and that there were other planets and that they might be inhabited. Servetus suffered the same fate for claiming that there were errors in the concept of the Trinity and that it was non-biblical. Galileo was condemned because he espoused the Copernican system, a system that yanked Earth and with it humans from the center of creation. Joseph Priestley was forced to flee from England after his laboratories were attacked in Birmingham because he was a Unitarian who asserted that Jesus was not the literal Son of God. But we are not going to retain what has been so costly won by simply asserting that reason and logic should be honored over mere belief. We know too much about how human beings work to return to that. Even economists now admit that people do not behave rationally in the market based on evidence that demonstrates that where money is concerned, people do not behave rationally, but rather indulge their hearts and souls when buying cars, houses, clothes, and everything else. I don't know why it took them so long to figure that out. I think the challenge to Unitarianism and to Unitarians everywhere is to develop and share a religion that provides something worth believing, worth cherishing, worth investing one's life in, while not leaving our brains at the door, while not succumbing to illusion and delusion, and while being true to ourselves, and by that I mean our hearts and souls as well as our brains. The Unitarian religion has always provided an abundance of things worth knowing. We need to strive just as hard and just as passionately to provide something worth believing. This won't happen by itself. Like the fundamentalists, we have to leave the safety of our sanctuary and venture out into the world and proclaim that it is possible to be both scientific and heartfelt, to demand understanding based on knowledge without throwing out our deeply held beliefs that nourish our souls. But that will require us to take a stand, to assert that this way, our way, is better than their way, and thus leave behind the shackles of political correctness and an irrational tolerance of things that we don't believe in and that we actually believe hurt us and our neighbors. As you leave church today, consider that our building is invisible until you are on its very threshold. Consider that we are isolated from the world, and think about whether that is what you want for your religion, the one you've chosen, the one you believe in. Consider if you are willing to stand up for what you know and believe against a world engulfed in fundamentalist and irrational beliefs, beliefs that clash with much that we in this church hold dear. Consider if you are willing to be a beacon on a hill before it's too late.